This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Relating to Yisurin and relating to suffering. And there's been a lot of feedback from that shiur and a lot of difficulty in understanding certain things, so I'm going to expand that shiur a little bit further tonight. Its connection with the Sedra is possibly only in as much as we read today about the Matzora, the person who receives physical affliction, pain and suffering as a result of having done something wrong. But primarily I'm going to depart from the Sedra and simply take further the Jewish attitude, the Torah's attitude to suffering. What we said 2 weeks ago was basically that there's always sufficient good and sufficient pleasure and sufficient nachas in every breath of life to far outweigh the difficulties of any tzoras, of any suffering. And that one has to be able to use the pleasures of life. Not only must one not permit the tragedies of life to blot out the pleasures of life, but one has to in fact use the pleasures of life to help one cope with the tzoras of life. Even at the moments that the tzoras are at their climaxes, one has to somehow be able, even at those moments, to see the nice side of things and to see the pleasure as well. We gave a couple of examples to that effect. The one was Yosef, who even while he was on his way to be sold to Mitzrayim and thought he would never see his father again, was still able to enjoy the pleasant smells of the perfumes and the spices which were being carried by that caravan of camels that took him down. And the other example we gave was the din that when a person has to shulam hears that a parent has died, one of the brochas he has to make is a shechionis. Despite all the solace and all the sadness of such a moment, there's also a touch of nachas, one little touch of nachas that he lands up with an inheritance. He has a yerusha. He takes over his father's place. He succeeds his father. And we mustn't stifle that little bit of nachas. It's got to be expressed. It's got to be noted, related to, and expressed. But I want to focus down a little bit further. And we find an amazing din, particularly in the way it's expressed in the Mishnah, in Brachos Daf Nun Dalet. Chayev Odom Levorech Al Haro'o Kishem Shemavorech Al HaTzeva. Not only do you have to make a shechionim at a moment of tzoras because you're hearing some good news as well, and there's a touch of good news, not only that, but chayiv odom levorech al haro, you've also got to make a brocha on the sad news itself. Chayiv odom levorech al haro kishem shemavorech al hatzri. The Gemara is amazed with this, and the Gemara assumes it cannot possibly mean that you've got to make a bracha for the bad itself. It seems strange, and the Gemara assumes and says, surely this means, and that Tanakh and the Beis, my chayv levarech al haro kishem shemavarech al hatoiva. What does it mean? Ilem a kishem shemavarech al hatoiva hatoiva ametiv kach mevarech al haro hatoiva ametiv. It probably means that you've got to make the same bracha, which is difficult enough to understand. Fasnana b'soyves toyves omer hatoiva ametiv. Didn't we learn that on good news you say Hatoiv Ametiv, Al Besoiris Roif Omer Boruch Zayin Emet? There's a completely different brocha which you say for bad news. So how can you possibly say it? But it's just coming to tell you that in the same way as you say that brocha for good news, you say the same brocha for bad news. Omer Rova Eloi Nitzucho. No, what does this thing come to tell you? Elo Lekablinu Besimcho. It comes to tell you that you've got to accept the bad with Simcho. Unbelievable. So now, not only does one have to be able to use the simchas of every breath of life to counteract the effect of misery, but one has to be able to accept misery with simcha as well. And here we come dangerously close to misunderstanding the Torah's attitude to Yisurin and equating them, chas v'sholem, to the attitude of Christianity. And one has to understand very clearly the differences here, and how to relate to them and how to understand them, and that's what the shiur is about. How is one mekabel yisurim ba'ahava? How can you do such a thing unless you're a Christian? There they say, oh, this is wonderful, to bask in one's difficulties and in one's problems. And yet there is such a concept, to be mekabel b'simcha. This will also help us further with the concept that we developed 2 weeks ago, and that is the chilul Hashem, of displaying the anguish of suffering. Feeling anguish of suffering is bad enough. We see we're not even supposed to feel that in many ways. We'll define it more clearly later on. But displaying anguish is a terribly serious thing. Coming over as a troubled person is not the way a Jew is meant to look and appear at any time. And this helps to reach that level. If one can be makabel, not only can one blot one's yisurin out with the pleasures of life, but one can even find some crazy kind of simcha in the yisurin themselves. It will help us avoid that chilul Hashem of appearing overburdened without torah chas v'sholom. The first thing one has to understand is that there are torahs and there are torahs, and one has to, as difficult as it is, relate to torahs intellectually. One really has to conceptualize them. If one doesn't, one relates emotionally and spontaneously, one finished before one stops. The intellect is the method given to the human being to cope with his life, and we're going to see that here more than ever. If one isn't going to use one's intellect at every step of the way, one's not going to be able to cope with life the way the Torah requires one to cope with life. And the first thing one has to do with Torah is to be able to distinguish. One has to be able to take stock of one's Torah and figure out what they are. The first kind of Torah I want to talk to you about are the Torah that a woman goes through during childbirth. It's terribly painful, I believe. Terribly, terribly painful. It's so painful that Halacha assumes that a woman, despite the greatness and the tremendous experience of childbirth, the Halacha assumes that a woman is going to take a vow, either verbally or to herself, never to have a child again. It's such an assumption that every woman goes through such thoughts at the moment of childbirth. It must be terribly, terribly painful. Imagine a husband who stands by his wife who's busy going through the labor pain and is crying his heart out and, oh, what's happening to me? And Ribbono Shel Olam, what are you doing to me? All this suffering, all this pain. I'm a sugar. He can't see one inch further than his nose. There's chevlei leda. It so happens that the world is so created since the chet of Adam HaRishon that many great things are preceded by terrible suffering. That's the way it is. We might get some insight a little bit further on as to why it must be like that. But first let's face the fact that's just how it is. And the man who stands next to his wife during childbirth crying and wearing sackcloth and ashes because of the terrible sorrows he's experiencing is a man who can't see further than his nose. And a man like myself who sits in a dentist chair and is terrified and won't go to the dentist for years because he doesn't know what they're going to do to him there is also can't see beyond his nose. What do you go to a dentist for? Not for the pain. You've got to have a bit of pain to fix yourself up, that's all. If one would just approach it intellectually, it wouldn't be a problem. But one doesn't always approach pain intellectually. One sometimes approaches it in a very, very basic way, and that's where the problems really start, because if one will just analyze what it is, and one will just see beyond the pain, to understand that sometimes to fix something up is painful. Sometimes to create something new is painful. Sometimes to achieve something wonderful has a very painful road before it, and one has to go through that painful road. Before it, a plant can grow. The seed actually has to die and rot and decay before the thing can actually grow. That's how life is. There's sometimes death and misery and decay and degeneracy, because out of that something has to blossom and something has to flower. And that's how life is. Yaakov Avinu was a Novi. He was a prophet. And he could see far into the future. And he thought that he'd lost his favorite son. His heir, not just his son, but his heir. The son who he had devoted most time to, and he'd given over all his Torah, that which he learnt in Shem Va'eva, that which was handed down to Yaakov. Yaakov handed down to Yosef. He put all his expectations in Yosef. Now Yosef is gone. And he believes Yosef is dead. And he goes into eternal suffering, eternal mourning, He can't get out of it. And God criticizes him and says, Ani oisek lahamlich b'noi b'mitzrayim. I, says God, am busy setting the stage for Yosef to become king of Egypt. V'ata oimer lama hara Yosef. And you, Yaakov, go around with tears and a bent back, and you say, Oy Ribbono Shel Olam, why have you been so unkind to me? I'm making your son king of Egypt, and you're saying, why have I been unkind? And as king of Egypt, he'll save you and all your family, and you're talking about me being unkind? Yes, for me to make him king of Egypt, I'm sorry, he has to leave you for a few years. He can't live here in Israel and be king in Egypt. And to put him in Egypt is hard, it requires suffering. But Yaakov, see beyond your nose. So we see even Yaakov with his nevuah, no, he lost his nevuah in fact because of this. Because of his misery and his pain and suffering, he lost his nevuah. You can't reach high spiritual levels when you're miserable. And that again confirms the shiur of 2 weeks ago. Not only is there chilul Hashem in being miserable or in appearing miserable, but you can't even reach high spiritual levels if you're miserable. Not possible. A person has to be happy, a person has to be full of life. And if one isn't, one can't reach it. And Yaakov, because he lost his love of life, at that time in fact lost his Ruach HaKodesh, he lost his Nevuah, he lost his prophecy, and he was unable to see. Not into the next century or the next 5 centuries, the same decade, just a few hundred miles down the road, another country. Couldn't link the two. And that's what one has to understand. That's the first thing one has to understand with Yisurim. Many wonderful things are painful. And don't believe that necessarily because things are painful that they're miserable. Sometimes they're chevle leida. Sometimes you're merely experiencing the pain of giving birth. That's a wonderful pain. It's a pain which is the pain that comes from creating. The pain that comes from making something that was never there before. And who knows what comes out of the pain and suffering. That's the first thing that one has to know with pain. The second thing is that life is made of highs and lows. If you think back, the times that you felt most alive emotionally were at moments of great simcha and moments of great tsar. You felt alive, not that anybody wants it on themselves, but that's what it is. You know, an economy that is stagnant is terrible. In an economy that is stagnant, even a Jew can't make money. In an economy which is in recession, Goyim can't make money so easily, but Jews can. And in an economy which is booming, everybody can make money, even an idiot. That's not difficult. If things are going down, well then it's very simple. It means that you can buy things cheaper than you can sell them. You can sell them now and buy them tomorrow and you can make a profit. If things are going up, you do it the other way around. You can buy today and sell tomorrow and you make a profit. But if things are stagnant, you can do nothing. That's when you're in trouble. And it's the same emotion. When an emotion is stagnant, there's nothing there. When an emotion is stable, we talked last week about the sun and the moon. Well, the sun's emotions, you can't do anything. It's always there, it's always in the same place, it doesn't move. You can't do much with it. Emotions have to go through the same cycles that an economy goes through. Imagine, for example, if you want to build up pressure, you want energy, you want steam energy. You take a cylinder and you start pushing steam into it. And you start pushing air, compressed air into it. And you push more and more and more and more. And still more and still more. And you press and you force and you force and you press. And then you open a tiny little hole in the cylinder. And it comes right up. And that creates the energy. But if you haven't got the pressure in the cylinder, you're not going to have energy outside. And if the hole is too big, you won't have energy coming out either. It's necessary to create the pressure in order to release that pressure to achieve the energy that you really require. If the Ribbono Shel Olam would just give us big simchas all the time, always singing and dancing, always drinking and having halachayims and singing and dancing, everything's wonderful, everything's happy, no problem. That's not simcha. That's stagnancy. That's a stagnant emotional economy. You can't achieve anything with that. It goes up and it goes down. And sometimes the downs are long. and they pump more and more and more and more in. And then a little hole is open, and the simcha comes out. And that's in fact what Pesach was. Imagine Yetzias Mitzrayim if they were only in Egypt for two weeks, and they weren't in Egypt as slaves of Pharaoh, but they were on a Masrav and Watson tour, and the Ribbono Shel Olam took them out with miracles. Would be flat. Pesach would never have survived until this day. It was necessary, unfortunately, to go through those 400 years of misery in order to feel the thrills of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that those thrills should survive, and we should try somehow to reenact them on Pesach night. And we have the maror, and we have the matzah, and we do whatever we can to try and relive at least one moment, the moment that pressure was released. But it's the release of the pressure which gives the simcha, not the absence of pressure. And in order to release pressure, you need to create pressure. And that's Torah. That's Yisurim. Sometimes it's a painful process. But you can always know when the pain is building up. It might continue to build. It might go on for a long time. But at some point, there's going to be a little prick in the cylinder. And it's going to come out with a tremendous thrill. Tremendous height being able to reach, to be reached. One has to know that that's going to happen. That's the second attitude that one has to have to Yisurim. First one is one has to know that it's not necessarily bad. It might be Hevle Leda, it might be birth pangs. The second thing to know is even if it's not birth pangs in any direct sense, this isn't directly leading to the creation of something new, but it's building up the emotional pressure. It's giving me the opportunity to feel simcha later on. That's what we always say. You wouldn't know what night was if you didn't have day, and you wouldn't have day if you didn't have night. It's not just contrast. It's the contrast which creates the pressure, and it's the pressure which we really are after. You know the famous story of the person who came to the Rav and said, life is miserable, he can't afford more than his one room house, and he's got his wife and his mother-in-law and his parents and his 10 children in the house already, and he just can't cope. He's going around the bend. The psychiatrist has given up hope already. You know the famous story. The Rosh says, "Oh, sure, no problem. Take the lamb in as well. You've got a sheep in the garden. Put the sheep in the house as well." He thinks the Rosh is meshugge. He puts the sheep in. Comes back a week later. He says, "It's worse." I said, "Worse? I'm sorry to hear this. My goodness, you better take the chickens and put them in the house too." The Rav, you just tells you do, otherwise you've got to move to another town. You can't live in a town and ask the Rav Shaila and then not do what he tells you to do, so you've got to do it. So he takes the chickens in, and he's really on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Comes back to the Rav. The Rav says, "What else have you got there in the yard there?" He says, nothing. He says, no, tell me the truth. A goat, that's all I've got. Put the goat in too. A week later, he's already sick, and the Rav has to come and see him. Calls the Rav, and the Rav comes. "What's the matter?" He says, "I'm having a nervous breakdown." "What's it like? Kick the chicken out, kick the goat out, kick the sheep out, and you'll find it a beautiful pleasure." The calf harvest, so it was. Sometimes to appreciate simple things, you need the pressure. Then you've got a story where the man had the same house before as he had after, but he was able to enjoy the pleasures of that little house. Whereas before he was unable to enjoy the pleasures because there was no release of tension. Tension needs to be built up and tension needs to be released. But don't believe the psychiatrists and psychologists who tell you that tension is bad and tension must be avoided. Tension must not be avoided. Tension must be created. I always say, if there's no tension in the violin strings, there's no music. You can't create music without tension. You can't live a beautiful life without tension. There's only one place where you can go to avoid tension. That's West Park Cemetery. Peaceful and it's quiet and there's no tension there. If you're a living human being, if you're in this game of living, there's going to be tension, and you should welcome the tension, because out of the tension you can create the pleasure, you can create the exhilaration of being alive when that release comes. There's another aspect to Yisurim. Sometimes Yisurim are not to build up tension, but that's simply because you misbehave yourself. Very directly connected to something that you did or that you're not doing. There's another simcha. It's the simcha of responsiveness, of feeling, there's nothing worse than coming into a shir, or to describe to you how bad coming into a shiur, with how bad this experience is, I'll tell you that there's a case where a rov, when people used to come and ask him what they can do to fix up something they've done wrong, he was very good at that. The Rebbe, he was known to be very good at giving them good advice on this matter. And one day he was asked, how do you manage to give such precise advice as to how to repair the wrongs that people have done? And this Rebbe answered, simply, I try and understand what they've done wrong in a way that I can understand properly. So I'll give you an example. Once a person came to me and said, Rebbe, I've been doing terrible things, and I need to put it right. I don't know what to do. I said, what have you been? I can't tell you. No, tell me, what is it? Is it to do with my work? This man used to work for the Chevra Kedisha. What terrible things to me, you're working for the Chevra Kedisha. What terrible things could you do? Presses the man, eventually he breaks down. And he says, Rebbe, I used to have sexual relationships with corpses. He said, alright, come and see me tomorrow, I have to think about this one. He says, how can I imagine, how can I figure out what to do? How can I put myself in that position? He thought, what is it that he could do which comes closest to that? And he came to an answer. He says, if I give a shiur to a sleeping audience, that's the same kind of experience. Exactly the same feeling. So you can imagine there's nothing worse, nothing more decadent than talking to an audience that is unresponsive. The only thing that is worse is probably to have a wife who's unresponsive. Come home and have a wife with a sort of a dull face that just doesn't change, doesn't smile, doesn't laugh, doesn't cry. Nothing, just dull. And contrary-wise, there's nothing more pleasurable than speaking to an audience that is responsive, or speaking to a person who is responsive, or having a wife who is responsive, and children who are responsive. And responsiveness is one of the most exciting things of being alive. And unresponsiveness is one of the most depressing things of being alive. And to see the Ribbono Shel Olam respond is one of the thrills of life. I've often talked to you about the child who sits around, can be a baby, very, very small child. Comes time to go to bed and he starts screaming. So his parents pick him up, and then he stops screaming, and his parents put him back again, and he carries on screaming. So they pick him up again and they walk him around. He's fine, laughing, everything's beautiful. So they put him back again and he carries on screaming. They take him out again, but they can't just carry him, they've got things to do. So they put him on the floor. This is already 8 o'clock at night. They put him on the floor with some toys, and he's having a lovely time. And they carry on doing what they're doing, and they try and put him back to bed again, and he screams. So they take him out again. This is 9 o'clock at night, 9:30, 10 o'clock, the kid's still messing around there. What does the kid think eventually when he collapses? What worms of parents have I got? What miserable worms. They can't even stand up to me. Who else can I rely on them to stand up against somebody from outside? Can I rely on the father to support me, to protect me? If he can't even stand my stress, I give a little squeak in my cot and he's scared, comes and takes me out. Whatever I want, he does. So to what extent can I rely on him? That's the letdown, the depression of unresponsiveness, inability to respond correctly. Sometimes we do naughty things, and if we get away with it, we feel a little bit let down, so to say, with the Ribbono Shel Olam's relationship to us. It's not nice. We like to feel, as every child does, that the Ribbono Shel Olam is watching and responding. I think I told some of you that when I went into my Rosh Yeshiva Shir in Sachasidim, I was terrified, because he was a very terrifying person altogether. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to learn in the shiur without asking questions. And I knew that you had to be terribly brave to ask questions in the shiur, and I wasn't that brave. I just didn't know how this would all work out. But I gave it a try. And watching, and I see people ask questions, and they're silly questions, and I see him tear them to pieces mercilessly. And I don't know. And I'm about to ask a question, and I hold back. No ways, I'm not going to put my head into his mouth. I'll just leave it alone. I'll rather ask somebody else afterwards. Eventually I thought, this has got to stop. I've got to start asking a question. So I spent the whole previous day working out a question on the Gemara. I spent the whole night working on it, checked it with a few boys. Everybody thought it was a good question. So I felt confident. And I was sitting just behind him, so that next to him, but just behind him. And I sort of interrupted him and I asked my question. And as it was coming out, I suddenly realized what a dumb question it was. Despite the fact I'd spent 24 hours on it, it was idiotic. And I must have gone white, I must have started trembling. I just didn't know what he was going to do. And he turned around, struck his beard. Very good question, he said, but if you look here and you look there, and he explained it very nicely. I felt a bit of relief. And that night I couldn't sleep. Because I did a little calculation. There were three groups of people in the shir. There were the average people who he totally ignored. It had nothing to do with it. There were the bad people who he was terribly kind to. The real idiotic ones. He was terribly sweet and kind to them. Whenever they, you know, just out of sheer ignorance and insensitivity, were able to ask a question, he used to treat them like they were gedolim. He used to treat them with tremendous respect. And whenever one of the good guys in the shir asked a question, he used to tear them to pieces, no matter what they said, even if what they said seemed to be good. I went to him the next day, even more scared, and I told him what I'd worked out. And I said, I'm worried. That means that I don't even fit into the average category. I'm really the worst. So he just grunted and walked off. As was his habit. And the next morning in the shir, I got it. And that was okay. That's when our relationship started. But then there was responsiveness. Then I understood. I didn't mind getting it in the neck from him, because that's how we were going to learn. That's how we were going to get to know one another. That's how we would grow. Chas v'sholom that I should fit into the category that he ignored, and even worse, into the category he was nice to. That was my terror. If I had nightmares in the middle of the night in yeshiva, and somebody would wake me up and say, "What are you dreaming?" I would say that the yeshiva had been nice to me. That would have been the most terrible nightmare that there could possibly be. Because we weren't ready for him yet to be nice. That came later, years later, after years of being hammered and hammered and hammered. When we started thinking the way he wanted us to think, then he treated us like colleagues, and it was a different thing. But it took years, and one understood that and appreciated that, and one likes that with the Ribbono Shel Olam too. One likes to feel, Chas v'Shalom, when one makes a mistake, there's somebody nudging one, at least, if not hurting one, at least nudging one and pointing out that wasn't right. And it's a tremendously fine feeling to have. That's the third aspect of relating to pain. Number one, sometimes it's chevle ledo, it's only birth pain. Sometimes, not directly birth pains, but it's building up the pressure so that the release can come later. And sometimes it's just pointing out to one that we're not going quite right. We need to change direction a little bit. And that's also a truth. And there's an amazing Gemara in Brachos Daf Hey. The Gemara says the following: Amar Rava the Itaim Rav Chista. Rava said, and according to some, it was Rav Chista who said, "Im roye adam sheyusurin boim alav." If a person sees that suffering comes to him, yefashpesh b'masav, he must analyze himself with tremendous self-criticism and brutality. Work out, what can it be that I'm doing wrong? His first assumption is that there's something I'm not doing right, and he should analyze and try and find what it is that I'm not doing right. Pishpesh v'loy mosa. If he went through everything he's doing with a fine-tooth comb, everything he does from morning until night, and he checks it against Shulchan Aruch, and there's nothing he's doing wrong. Yitle b'vitul Torah. Then he must assume that he's being hit because he's wasting too much time. He's not being productive enough with his time. He's not utilizing his time to maximum ability. And if he tried that too and he works out that that's impossible, that he's using his time to full maximum ability, this is some individual. This is a man who can't find anything wrong that he's done and is sure that he's using his time to maximum utility. In that case, it's for sure she yisurim shel ahavohem, but this is suffering of love. What suffering of love is Rashi? HaKadosh Baruch Hu miyatsoi be'olam hazeh beloy shum ovoy. God is causing suffering to him in this world without having done anything wrong. Kedei laharbeit choro le'olam habo yosei mekedei b'chi yosei. So as to give him reward in the world to come more than he really deserves. This Rashi has troubled me for many years. What does it mean? That God actually causes suffering although we've done nothing wrong? To give me more in the world to come than I deserve? What does it mean? Here one has to understand something very important with respect to suffering, and it's the primary mistake that everybody makes. Don't confuse suffering with living. That's the important thing to understand. Living is hard. It's hard to get up in the morning. It's hard to fry an egg for breakfast. It's hard to go to davening. It's hard to earn a living. It's hard to relate to people when you don't feel like relating to people. It's hard to listen to a shir on the Moshe Shabbos. And it's even harder to give a shir on Moshe Shabbos. And that's tough luck. That's what life is all about. Don't call that yisurim. That's the first thing one has to understand. Living is hard. Not necessarily unpleasant. It's hard. Living is coping with reality. That's what life is. Living is it's confronting reality. Being out there and working and doing and making, creating. That's what living is. And we tend, in our fear of pain, to insulate ourselves not from pain, but from life. And that's the danger. To build a house so that you're not outside in the rain, okay, it doesn't do anybody any harm occasionally to walk in the rain. It's a feeling and experience that one should have from time to time. But okay, one builds a house not to be in the rain. But then the house gets bigger and it has very plush furniture, so now not only do you protect yourself from the element, but when you sit down in your lounge chair, you protect yourself from any desire you might have had of wanting to get off that chair. Now there's no way you could ever want to get off that chair. So comfortable that all you want to do is stay where you are. And you've got air conditioning and central heating. You can adjust at the press of a button exactly what temperature you want. And if you want entertainment, you don't even have to go out to a theater. You just turn on a thing and there it is on a box in front of you, all the entertainment you want. Everything's inside the house. And the house becomes an insulated fortress. A barrier between you and real life. That's what it becomes. And then you go out to your office and you go in a car which with the windows closed and the radio blaring, plush seats, air conditioning, heating. Again, you're just not in the real world. You're insulated and cut off from the real world. And you arrive in your office and it's the same story. Centrally heated, pipe music, everything you want. And there you mess around with things. You're not really doing real things. You're not making. You're not dealing with the real world. There are papers you've got to do in and out, and letters and telephones, it's all artificial things. The real world's outside, you're just pressing buttons. That's how our society is living more and more. We've insulated ourselves, not from solace, but from living. We're just not living. And we hire teachers for our children so that we don't have to have the solace. And we avoid spending time alone with our wives as much as we can so that we don't have to relate to them either. We either have other people with us, so we go out to them, or if we're both at home together, we turn on the television or have a home movie. That's how we cope with that one. So there's really no Torah at all at the end of it, and no living at all, no life. And we've confused the pain of Torah with the challenges of living. And that's a terrible thing. To climb a mountain is painful, but that's a challenge, it's not Torah. And to live is painful and hard, but that's not Torah. That's life. And one has to constantly work on this and develop it and confront it and cope with it. That's what it means to live. To handle the problems and the challenges and the opportunities which the Ribbono Shel Olam presents to us outside, not to run away from them. If we run away from them, what develops is a certain immaturity. If you live in this insulated house which I described, what you land up with is an immature individual, somebody who hasn't lived his full years. When you talk about somebody immature, you're talking about a man who's 40, let's say, but he's got the emotional development and the ability to cope of a man of 20 or 15 very often. What does that mean? He just hasn't had the experience of really living. He's operated for 20, for 40 years. His heart has been ticking for 40 years. But he hasn't been grappling with life for 40 years. Only for 20 years worth. You see, it depends what gear one works in. You can live outside in a tent. You can live outside without a tent. And that's working in top gear. Or you can come inside into your insulated palace, and that's working in logia. And there are various gears in between. And one can insulate oneself from life, one can work in low gear, but then you have to run 10 miles before you can develop the muscles that it normally takes 1 mile to develop. And if you go in a really high gear, then by walking 10 yards you can develop the muscles that it normally takes a mile to develop. And that's what a human being can control to a degree, and which God often does control for an individual. When we're talking about Yisurin Shel Ahavah, there's only a very narrow line, and perhaps the line doesn't exist at all. And I'll show to you in a moment why I say that. Perhaps there is no line between pain and life. Life is painful, it's hard, but it's exhilarating and thrilling. And one mustn't run away from that. One tries to cushion the discomfort because we have a natural desire to do so. But just to try and insulate oneself from life, that's not. You must be careful not to do that. Yisurim Shel Ahavah, sometimes the Ribono Shel Olam, if we can cope with it, God will never put us in a situation that we can't cope with. Each person is put in a situation that he knows they can cope with. But if God wants to, what he sometimes might do is shift us up a gear, make the going a little harder, make the living a little bit more intense, and hence a little bit more painful. But it's not the kind of pain to be worried or upset about. To jump into a cold swimming pool on a hot day is painful, but it's exhilarating. That's what one does. To have a heated swimming pool is operating in a low gear. That's not the way to do it. You lose the exhilaration by having a heated swimming pool. You have to make the temperatures exactly the same so that you don't feel the change as you walk from the air into the pool. That's the height of luxury. You don't feel the change, so why go for a swim? The whole exhilaration of the swim is in feeling the contrast. To walk out of a heated house into the cold outside, that's exhilaration, that's living. To have underground tunnels that you don't have to walk outside and straight into a car and out of a car, and you don't feel the outside at all, there's no exhilaration, that's not life. And one has to understand all the time that yes, protect oneself so that one can operate, but don't insulate oneself so that one's not living altogether. And when we talk about Yisurin Shel Ahavah, we're talking about shifting up a gear, that's all. Life becomes a little bit tougher, the obstacles are raised a bit. The things one has to jump over are a little bit higher than they were. The terrain is a little bit rougher. It's going to stiffen the muscles a little bit more. But in the same lifespan, you'll be able to achieve double. That's Yisurin Shel Ahavah. God only gives Yisurin Shel Ahavah when everything else is going too easily. If you're doing nothing wrong, then basically he's got to give you an easy life, but if he gave you an easy life, you wouldn't achieve. So he turns on the screws a little bit. That's your spiritual eye. What one has to be terribly careful about is not developing an insensitivity to pain. When we're talking about taking pleasure in pain, and we've described four ways in which one can take a certain pleasure in the pain. One can take pleasure in the pain because it's birth pain. One can take pleasure in the pain because one sees that the tension is increasing and the sunlight is going to come all of a sudden. One can take pleasure in the pain because it's responsiveness. You can associate a particular pain to a particular action, and you feel the warmth of God's proximity with oneself. And one can take pleasure in pain because it's Yisurin Shel Ahavah. God has shifted you into a higher gear so that you should achieve a little bit more. Those are the ways one can take pleasure in pain. And has to be careful that when we say take pleasure in pain, we don't mean become insensitive to pain. Not to jump into the swimming pool and leave it cold, but desensitize your skin to cold water before you jump in. That's also no good. The proof for that, Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski in fact brings from this Gemara which I just did with you. So the Gemara says that what is the din, that in the same way as you have to make a brocha on good, so you have to make a brocha on bad. Ask the Gemara, what brocha? Eilema, if this means k'shem shemavarech ala toiva ha-toiva ha-meitiv, kach mavarech ala ro ha-toiva ha-meitiv, can it mean that you make the same brocha ha-toiva ha-meitiv on suffering? No. You make Dayan Emes, which is a very different bracha. Dayan Emes is acknowledgement of the pain and the suffering. It's registering. It's like saying to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I can feel it. Stop. It had its effect. Thank you for pointing it out to me. Thank you for doing it. And that's enough. That's what Boruch Dei and Emet means. But to develop an insensitivity to it, like to develop the ability to, we started off saying on 2 weeks ago, that you should be chas v'sholem in pain and suffering. Let's imagine a person who has lost all his money and everybody's sick in the home and he's struggling and he's battling, and he sees this as an ideal situation. You know, that's how the Orthodox Jew is supposed to be. It's a sign that God loves him and all that, and he doesn't feel it. That's not right. You've got to feel the pain, but your simcha has to come as a result of having felt the pain, not feel the pain altogether. If you become insensitive to pain, that's mava'is b'yisurin, that's kicking yisurin aside. That's not right. One has to feel the pain and register it and be hurt by it and find a certain joy in that having been hurt. That's what it has to be. If I wouldn't have felt offended when the Rosh Yeshiva insulted me, there would have been no pleasure out of the insult. It's only because of the offense that I appreciate that an educational process is taking place, and I enjoy that educational process. And it's sore, it hurts, but that doesn't matter. I can tolerate the pain because I can see where it's going. But not that I don't feel the pain. That's a grob person. That's a really insensitive, coarse person who doesn't feel pain. One must feel the pain and be able to relate to it with a degree of pleasure, with a degree of simcha. We do that today. You know, you might say what I'm saying is obvious. Sure, one must be pretty coarse not to feel pain. The best example is earning a living. We've romanticized it already. Careers, professions, building empires, and all the books and the movies that are about it, and women are now reaching this new great age of liberation where they too can make careers for themselves. What does the Torah call it? A klola. A curse. The curse of having to earn a living. It's a Torah. Not something one should be happy that we have to do. Once we have to do it, we might as well enjoy it. That's something else. But there should be the knowledge that this isn't the way the world was meant to be. We should be meant to be taking it easy, learning, developing ourselves, building ourselves. That's what it was really meant to be. Not that we had to go out working. And to romanticize work and call it careers and professions and ambition and all the rest of it, that's the same idiocy which we're talking about here. To be mavayit b'yisurin, not to even notice that you're suffering a klola. And how will God ever remove that curse if we don't even notice that He's cursing us? That's the terrible thing. The Gemara says in Erchin that to put your hand into your pocket when you need 2 cents and pull out 3 cents, and now you've got to go to the trouble of putting 1 cent back in your pocket, that's yisurin. God's already trying to tell you something. Because if everything was perfect, you would put your hand in and you would take out 2 cents. If you have to go to town and you miss a robot on the way, that's yisurin. It shouldn't be necessary to miss a robot. If you have to drive around the block to find parking, that's yisurin. One has to know that that's yisurin and work out what is God trying to say, what's going on. Not become insensitive and take that as the norm. Okay, I didn't expect to find the parking place. That's not right. I would have loved to have found the parking place. And if I was a tzaddik, I would have found the parking place. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam want from me? What have I done? What's going on? What's he trying to tell me? Maybe he wants you to have the thrill of finding a parking place after driving around the block 20 times. Maybe it's Chevle Leda, or maybe while you're driving around the block and you're so miserable, you're going to pass by somebody who needs a lift and you'll do a very big mitzvah. Maybe it's none of those things. Maybe you've done something wrong, you wasted some time, so you think if you've got so much time, you might as well drive the block around the block a little bit as well. And maybe you are a tzaddik, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is just trying to make the going a little bit rougher. But the Gemara says that that wouldn't be, because when the Ribbono Shel Olam uses Yisurim Shel Ahava, when he shifts you up a gear, it doesn't cause spiritual slowdown. And when you're driving around the block, you can't be learning, you can't be doing anything very productive unless you've got a tape recorder of a shir on in your car. Then it might be Yisurim Shel Ahava, or maybe the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to finish the shir before you find the parking. It can be one of those things as well, but one has to understand. And if you don't see it as Yisurim, you won't have the communication. You won't have the thrill of feeling that God's really talking to you if you don't even see that there's something wrong with it. And it's amazing how when you hit it right, you say, oh, I know what it is. I didn't do this this morning, I did do this this morning. You can be sure 2 yards down the road there'll be a parking place. That's how it goes. That's how it works. The message has got through. There's no reason for the Yisurin anymore. I just want to finish off with one other Gemara. That is, the Gemara bases itself on a pasuk in Iyov. Adam le'amal yulad. Man was born for hard work. I'm using this pasuk to show you, firstly, that life and suffering, that's what it is. Life is suffering. And you can't escape, so you can't escape death. There's a time when we're all going to die. That's life. Life is death too. That's part of life. Unfortunately, we're all going to come into contact with death. And it's a terrible klala if we don't. If chas v'sholom, we die before we come into contact with death. Children die before parents, chas v'sholom. Die before one's generation, before the other people of one's generation. That's a curse. So if we live the way we're meant to live, we live out a long life in Yud Hashem, we're going to come into contact with death.
Omar Rabbi Elazar, Kol Adam Le'amal Nivra. Every man is born to work. Don't think you'll escape hard work. And Omal doesn't just mean work. Omal means sweat and toil. Hard, hard work. You're not going to get away with from that. Everybody gets it. Shneimar Zetzki Adam Le'amal Yulad. Eini Yodayim Le'amal Pen Nivraim Le'amal Melocha. But I don't know what type of hard work is that. Does that mean that I could get away with intellectual hard work? Using my mouth, speaking, expressing things, creating intellectual ideas, or does it mean I'm going to have to work hard physically? When it says that his mouth is to him like a saddle, in other words, he's burdened himself with the responsibilities of his mouth. I know that he's really created for intellectual hard work. He doesn't have to work physically hard. You can get away with intellectual hard work. Not that intellectual hard work is any easier than physical hard work, but that gives me a direction. But I still don't know if he's meant to use that expression in Torah or in general discussion. When it says there's a din that this Sefer Torah should not remove from your mouth, day and night you should be working in Torah. Then I know that it's Omal Torah. In other words, what the Gemara is telling you here is that work, you're going to have to work. But you can channel your Yisurin. You can find your Yisurin in intellectual areas and in spiritual areas. For example, one wants to do something wrong. One has to stop oneself. That's hard, it's Yisurin, that's pain and suffering. And that's the pain and suffering of life. That's living. To stop oneself from doing an avera one would love to do. It's terribly, terribly, terribly hard. But that's part of Yisurim. One grows through those Yisurim. God communicates through those Yisurim. Gears shift up through those Yisurim. That's what creates an intense life. And if you want to shift gears down, doing the avera, that's shifting down. So you're taking the easy way. You can't face the difficulty of withholding. So you shift down a gear. Okay, now you're going to have to run for it. Because now you have to work much harder. And then one of two things happen. Either you do tshuva, and I must tell you from experience, that as hard as it is to stop yourself doing an avera, and it's terribly hard, doing tshuva is 10 times harder. Having done the avera, correcting it, is at least 10 times harder. You can't imagine how much harder it is. That's the Omer. You can't escape the hard work. You're faced with the Avera, you want to do it. You have two choices. Either you don't do it, which is hard as anything, or you do it, and to correct it is going to be still harder. Or you'll do it and you won't correct it. Then you'll get Yisuri. Then God's going to hit you some way or another. Comes later on in life. But you can't escape the Omal, you can't escape the hard work. Whichever channel you take, you're going to have to plod along, overcoming one challenge after another, one obstacle after another. And that's hard and that's challenging. And finally, to show you that, in fact, Yisurim, suffering and living is the same, or it's very possible, possibly the same. On this pasuk, there are two explanations given. on the pasuk of Ki Adam La'omal Yulad, man is born to work hard. The one explanation is the explanation of the Metsudos. And the Metsudos says, why is man born to work hard? Because nobody wants to be a leech. Nobody wants to take from others. If you want to have it easy, you've got to take from others. If you want to achieve yourself, that's hard. And that's the most difficult thing that people find to understand in today's societies and economies. You want to raise your standard of living, that's today taken as a right. Everybody has the right to raise their standards of living. Fine, okay, if you think you have such a right, that's fine. But how are you going to raise your standard of living without working harder? It can't be done. And if it is done, then somebody else is paying for you. Don't you understand that? You can't take more by not giving more. And if you aren't giving more, if you're not more productive and you get raise your standard of living, then somebody else is forking out and you're a leech. And that, says the Metsudos, is not why we were put here. We were put in this world to face the thrill of achieving our own success, of doing it all ourselves. And if you're going to do it yourself, it's hard. If you want to be spoon-fed, it's easy. If you want to do it yourself, it's hard. That's the Metsudos. Rashi says, no, la'adam la'omal yulad, means man is born to suffer, because everybody does averas. It's not possible to be living a dynamic life and not occasionally do something wrong. And if you do something wrong, you're going to have to suffer for it. So Rashi takes the omal as suffering, and the Metsudos takes the omal as living. And I say they're both the same. They're not saying anything different. That's it. Living and suffering become very close together. One tries to cushion oneself against it. One tries to choose one's suffering in productive areas. Rather, one chooses one's suffering in not doing Averas, and if one did an Avera, in doing Tshuva, in sitting up a little bit later to understand a piece of learning, going to a shiur when one might otherwise have gone to entertainment. Those are the challenges we choose for ourselves to make life worthwhile. But if chas v'sholem we don't, then Rashi is right. Then God brings the tragedies and the difficulties in some other way. Be that as it may, as it happens and as life occurs, Adam la'omal yulad, there's always hard work. Every day is hard. Every day is difficult if we're going to achieve. If you've had an easy day, it's likely to have been an empty day. A productive day is a difficult day. And we like to make our days productive, not only in a material sense, but more important in a spiritual sense. And to make a day productive in a spiritual sense is hard. But all one must be able to do when one looks back at a day, or at a week, or at a month, or when one's right in the middle of the pain and suffering, is to be able to classify that pain into one of the four areas. Either it's chevle leida, one's about to give birth, or the pressure's being turned on so that the release can come later. Or it's communication, we've done something wrong and the Ribbono Shel Olam is nudging us. And if we take notes now, he won't nudge us anymore. If we don't take notes, he nudges a bit harder. Or it's Yisurin Shel Ahava. The Ribbono Shel Olam is simply shifting gears up so that we can achieve more in a shorter period of time. It's one of those four things. There is no other basis for Yisurin. We don't encounter suffering for any other than these four reasons. And this one has to be able to know when the suffering comes, to help us face the suffering, work through the suffering, and be mekabel the suffering besimcha, not become insensitive to the suffering, but see the simcha in the suffering itself. See the light that lies at the end of the tunnel to enable us not only to endure that suffering, but to come out at the end of it much greater and more enhanced people than we were.